okay, we've seen some ancient Greeks, and we need to move forward to more modern times, much more modern times. But before we do that, we have to sort of take a bit of a stop off in that intermediate period. Now, you may be asking why there is such a gap. I mean, we were in ancient Greece, and we're, you know, in the 3rd and 4th and 5th centuries BCE, and then we're going to move forward to a much more modern time, and we're talking about people like Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill. And there we're talking about 18th and 19th century. I mean, we're talking about a 2,000-year jump. And you may be wondering why that's the case. We are stopping off today in the 13th century, but that's still a 1,500-year jump. Now, this is kind of the way that a lot of the history of science and philosophy is taught in these introductory kinds of courses, where there's sort of a lot happening in the ancient times, then we move forward quite a bit and talk about much more modern times, usually in terms of the 17th century with people like Descartes, but we're skipping ahead of him to Bentham and Mill. But anyway, there's a lot of reasons for that, and it's not that nothing is happening in the interim. It's really not. There's a lot of really interesting things happening in that intermediate period. I don't mean to suggest that there's not, but the issue for an intro class like this is that most of that stuff happening in the interim is commentary on and development of those ancient ideas. There aren't really that many wholly new ideas. It's mostly talking about things in relation to or in development of the ancient stuff. It's not until we get to the 17th century, really, with people like Descartes, where we get a real, truly sort of new look at things, and a real revolution in the way that science and philosophy and everything else is approached. So, yes, we are going to make that traditional jump from the ancient times to the more modern times, but I thought it helpful, perhaps, if we took a little stop in the 13th century to give you an idea of the kind of thing I'm talking about. And there's not much more of an influential person that we could talk about than Thomas Aquinas. Now, Aquinas is certainly not the only important thinker of this period, he's certainly not the only one doing what he's basically trying to do and figure out the things that he's basically trying to figure out. But for better or worse, he is the kind of big main recognized pillar of thought during this time, and it just so happens that he is closely related to somebody we've already talked about at least in his work. Now, Aquinas, a little bit of background here. Aquinas is kind of trying to solve a bit of a problem. When I said that a lot of the intermediate interim stuff here that's happening, the thought that's happening, is development of previous ancient ideas. The major one here is Aristotle. For a long time, Aristotle was really thought of as the guy. He is the one who basically, many scholars basically thought, you know, Aristotle pretty much figured it all out. We just have to fill in some holes and details and things like that. But he pretty much figured it out. There's not much that Aristotle didn't write about. He wrote about all sorts of things, and many scholars thought that he pretty much got the basics right. We just have to kind of iron out the details. But, so he's the authority. Aristotle is the authority. But then, of course, we have the church. Now, we are, of course, talking about the Catholic Church, because that was the only, it was just the church, because that was the only church in the area of the world at the time. In fact, the word Catholic, when it's a small c, not a capital C, when it's the big C, it's talking about the church. But when it's a small c, Catholic means universal. That's what it means. So it was just the church to the people at the time. And of course, the church is also an authority. And what started to happen was these scholars who were developing the details of Aristotle's thought, some of them started to think, here's what Aristotle says, and here's what follows from this, and what follows from this seems to conflict with what the church says. In other words, if Aristotle's right, the church is wrong, and if the church is right, Aristotle's wrong. So there's this kind of big problem. I mean, Aristotle is this authority, this big major figure in the history of thought that has been understood and has been studied and has been followed for centuries and centuries and centuries, for a millennium and a half almost at this point. And then we don't want to just throw that away, right? We don't want to just say that's just completely wrong. But on the other hand, there's the church. We don't want to throw that away either. We certainly don't want to say the church is wrong. It's dangerous to our health if we do that. So, what do we do? If one's got to go, we got a problem. Major, major issue. In comes Thomas Aquinas to the rescue, and Thomas Aquinas says, I got this, guys. It's actually not a problem. It's actually okay. Because you guys are not understanding Aristotle right. If you understand Aristotle properly, you will see that there's no conflict at all. In fact, if you understand Aristotle properly, you will see that what he has said has actually upheld and supported what the church is teaching. The problem is, with Aristotle, is not that he's wrong, it's that he's incomplete. Because, look, Aristotle was around long before the church was around, long before Jesus was around, right? So, of course, Aristotle didn't know about Jesus because he was before Jesus. Aristotle did what he could with the information that he had. More information has come to light. Now we can add on to Aristotle and expand him. So again, it's not that Aristotle was wrong, it's just that it's incomplete because he didn't have all the info. So essentially, what Aquinas wants to do is he wants to take Aristotle and Christianize him. He wants to take the basic ideas of what Aristotle put forth and mesh them together with the church's teachings. Now, how does he go about doing that? Well, we're going to talk about, it's clearly not going to talk about all of what Aquinas has to say. He's a very, very, very deep, his catalog is, well, there's two major, major books in there. There's the Summa Contra Gentiles and the Summa Theologica, and these two major works are very, very deep, very thick, very dense, very, very hard, very hard to get through, and we're certainly not going through an entire class on Aquinas. So I'm just going to make a couple of basic points here to see what you make of it. And of course, this also, we need to recognize that this is coming from a completely Christian perspective, right? The idea that this Catholic Church was universal. Well, we know now, of course, that that's not universal at all. There were all sorts of different ideas happening at different parts of the world. And though that still continues to this day. But in Aquinas' time, in Aquinas' place in the world, it was universal, right? So we need to keep these kinds of things in mind, and we're just going to look at this as an example of one of the things that's happening in this sort of middle period. So, okay, first off, Aquinas says Aristotle is basically right. He's talking about happiness as being the good. That's true. He's talking about how we need to cultivate virtues within ourselves in order to kind of balance these things to get to this place of goodness and this place of virtue, such that we will have this happiness. And that's agreed. Aquinas agrees with all of that. The problem is, like I said before, that Aquinas says Aristotle was basically incomplete, right? He was only part of the way there. And Aquinas introduces this problem or this difference by talking about two different sides of things, right? He's thinking that, well, Aristotle looked at philosophy, right? He was looking at the world. He was looking at the information that he had, and the information that he had was gained from the world, from looking at the world and thinking logically about the world. And in so doing, Aristotle did an amazing job. However, Aquinas says, there are some things that you can't learn and you can't know just by thinking logically about the world. Those things can only be shown to us by the divine. Divine revelation. And of course, those things in Aristotle's time hadn't been divinely revealed yet. So again, it's not Aristotle's fault that he was incomplete. So what this means is, when we're thinking of Aquinas, there are two sides of this. We can think of these two sides as what we might call the natural law part, and then there's the divine command part. The natural law part is the stuff about morality that we can understand just about thinking about the natural world, using logic and reason and investigation on the natural world to come up with certain things that we can understand. The divine command part of morality is the stuff about morality that we can't figure out that way. We have to be told. It has to be revealed to us. So, when Aristotle's talking about your basic virtues, like justice, wisdom, courage, and these sorts of things, those are all natural things. We can understand, as Aristotle did, those sorts of virtues in that natural way. Now, Aquinas is going to expand on this natural law idea, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes, but that's basically the idea. Now, the problem wasn't that Aristotle was wrong in that happiness is the goal, but he was wrong in the kind of happiness that was the goal. Aristotle, remember, viewed it as eudaimonia. Aristotle viewed it as this happiness in this life. But of course, Aquinas, as you no doubt recognize, is going to say, no, 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 no. Happiness, yes, but it's not earthly happiness that we're after. It is heavenly happiness that we're after. So this, of course, is different than eudaimonia. It is what Aquinas calls beatitude. Beatitude. B-E-A-T-I-T-U-D-E. Beatitude or blessedness. Now, this blessedness or beatitude is happiness, but it's divine happiness. So what Aquinas does, he says, look, those things like, justice and courage and all that sort of stuff, that's all fine, right? I mean, those aren't bad things. That's good stuff, right? But those are things in the world, right? Those are natural kinds of things that we can understand, as Aristotle and Plato, for that matter, did long before us. Those are the sort of the cardinal natural virtues. The faith, the hope, and the... getting ahead of myself here. The justice and the temperance and the courage and the wisdom and all that sort of stuff. But what Aquinas adds on to that is what he calls the theological virtues. And I started to say them a moment ago already. Those theological virtues are faith, hope, and charity. And beatitude is inachievable without them. Faith, hope, charity. Now, for Aquinas, these are words that you're familiar with, no doubt, but they're generally used in the way that you probably generally use them, except probably for charity. Faith is basically trust, right? It is this trust in the divine authority of God, regardless of, you know, earthly evidence. Hope is about the belief, the trust that life, eternal life in heaven, in God's presence, is coming after death. Charity, so those are sort of, you know, used as they normally are, but charity is a little different. Charity in the theological virtue sense is about basically loving God for his own sake. Not loving God because of what he's going to give you. Not loving God because he can make your life better or grant your prayers. Not loving God because doing so will hopefully get you a ticket into heaven. No, loving God for his own sake. That's what charity is about. So, without those things, true happiness, i.e. beatitude, cannot be achieved. These things, faith, hope, charity, and the things that we need to do in accordance with those things, the actions that we need to undertake in accordance with those virtues, cannot be understood just by thinking about the world. They have to be divinely revealed to us. So, basically here, basic picture of what's going on here is that Aquinas is taking Aristotle and saying, yeah, basically Aristotle got it right, but there's some missing information. We can figure out courage, and we can figure out wisdom, and we can figure out justice. We can figure out that happiness should be the goal, right? We can figure out that virtue is going to be the path to happiness. We can figure all that stuff out. Hey, Aquinas even says we can even figure out, just by thinking about the world and using logic, we can even figure out that God exists. So there's all sorts of things that we can figure out that we should and shouldn't do in the basically Aristotelian way, the basically natural way. But there are other things that we have to have God reveal those things to us. So let's turn back then to this natural law versus divine command. Now, this is Aquinas' take on this. This isn't exactly what Aristotle was getting at quite, but it is Aquinas' take on this divine command and natural law stuff. The idea behind natural law is look at the world to find out what we should do and how we should act. How? Well, look at what's natural. God created the world and everything in it, Aquinas is claiming, and so therefore, when one creates something, one does so with a purpose in mind. Think about stuff that you do, things that you create, things that you build, things that you, whatever. Anything that you create because of some reason. You create it for some purpose. Even if that purpose is to eliminate your boredom, right? I mean, if you're doing a jigsaw puzzle or something just to keep yourself occupied, that's its purpose. It's to keep you occupied. In other words, anything that you do or create has a purpose. It's the same for God. If God created all this stuff, he created all this stuff with a purpose. So all we need to do is figure out what those purposes are and abide by them. That's the idea behind natural law. So what Aquinas is going to say is, let's look at the world. We notice that, cows are docile and they're really good at providing us with milk and with meat. That must be what they're for. And sheep are good at keeping our fields grazed and providing us with wool such that we can create clothing for ourselves. That must be what they're for. And dogs are really good at herding those sheep and keeping them protected. That must be what they're for. And cats are really good at keeping my keeping varmints and pests out of my crops and out of my my house and things like that. That must be what they're for, right? So act, do things according to their natural purpose. Incidentally, it should be pretty obvious at this point when you think about it why the Catholic Church is against certain things like contraception and abortion and even homosexuality. Pretty clear, Aquinas is going to say. It's pretty clear what the purpose of sexual reproductive organs are. Penises and vaginas are for making babies. That's what they're for. That's their purpose. So to use them for things against that purpose, or to actively try to hinder or stop that purpose, must be morally wrong. That's where that sort of thing comes from. Now, I would wager that many of you might have a few things to say about this natural law idea. By all means, do so in a discussion post. But then we have to look at the divine command part as well. The basic idea of natural law is what's right is what's natural. The basic idea behind divine command is what's right is what God says. We don't need God to tell us that penises and vaginas are for making babies. We don't need, according to Aquinas, we don't need God to tell us that ears are for hearing and noses are for smelling and, you know, cats are for catching critters and sheep are for this and horses are for that. We don't need God to tell us that sort of stuff. We can figure that stuff out on our own by looking at the natural world, says Aquinas. However, when you want to start saying things like, thou shalt not create, make unto thee any graven images, right? Or remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. Or thou shalt have no other gods before me. You know, when you're talking about things like that, you can't just look at the world and figure them out. When we learn things, you know, from this divine revelation, things even like that God is a Trinity, for example, is something clearly Aquinas is going to claim. This is not stuff that we can just figure out. This is stuff we have to be told by divine revelation. So those sorts of moral rules, those sorts of things that we should follow, according to Aquinas, those have to be told to us. Those are the divinely revealed things. That is the divine command. So, what's right is what's natural, and what's right is what God says. Now, these are two different ideas that in Aquinas mesh together. They don't have to. You could be a divine command person without even bringing in natural law. You could be a natural law person without bringing in divine command. You could be a natural law person without believing in God at all. But in Aquinas, these two different ideas come together. They mesh together. And the result is this expansion and extension of what Aristotle gave us previously. Now, that is, of course, just a tiny little snapshot of what Aquinas is going on about. I want to ask a couple of questions to get your minds working. First of all, obviously, as I said before, Aquinas is coming from the Catholic, Christian, specifically Catholic perspective. But we can still ask more general questions about what you think of his basic approach. First question is, what do you think of natural law? Maybe not even necessarily Aquinas's version of it, but natural law in general. What do you think of using nature, using what's natural to determine what's moral? What do you think of that? Second question, what do you think of divine command in general, using what God says as the basis for what we should do? If you want to talk about these things further, the further questions I want to ask are this. When we're talking about natural law, if you want to say what's right is what's natural, then it seems pretty important to first answer the question, what does natural mean? When somebody says something is natural or unnatural, what exactly does that mean? What does a claim of natural mean? It's an important thing to answer if we're going to talk about determining morality based on what's natural. Second question that comes with divine command is, if we're going to say the divine command route, then why is there so much disagreement about that? I mean, on the surface of it, what's right is what God says. I mean, what higher authority could you need, right? But on the other hand, if that's the case, if it were as simple as that, then why would there be so much disagreement about it? What do you think the source of that disagreement is? And is there a way to get past that disagreement? So, after this little look, this little snapshot look at Aquinas, who is this Aristotelian, we're going to move forward into more modern times and talk about some development of the consequentialist idea. Before I end here, I just want to make one little final, not argument against Aquinas at all, but really just sort of a point of caution. If you were to see a scientist who had some sort of hypothesis and is designing an experiment to show or confirm or disconfirm this hypothesis, that is, and you were to find out that this scientist deliberately designed that experiment such that it would confirm the hypothesis, you'd probably think that that experiment was probably not that reliable, right? So the scientist has this hypothesis, and that hypothesis may very well be true, but we probably shouldn't really just stop there and rely on this scientist's experiment if the scientist had deliberately designed the experiment such that the result would be confirmation of the hypothesis. That's not the way to do science. That's bad science. In the realm of philosophy, that's kind of what it seems like has happened here with Aquinas. Before Aquinas started, he already had a goal in mind. He already knew what he wanted to achieve. He wanted to achieve a meshing and bringing together of Aristotle and church teaching. He wanted to bring the two together. He wanted to Christianize Aristotle. He had the goal in mind before he started of bringing them harmoniously to complement one another. It seems then that he deliberately designed his philosophy to specifically achieve that goal. Now, all by itself, that doesn't automatically mean he's wrong, of course, right? Like, that scientist's hypothesis may have actually been right. Maybe if he did a truly fair experiment, his hypothesis would have been supported. But he didn't do a fair experiment. He did a rigged experiment. So we can't really trust that experiment. To figure out if the hypothesis really is true, we would have to look at a different experiment. We'd have to look at independent evidence. What Aquinas has done is kind of similar to that, it may seem. He may be right, but he did seem to set out from the beginning with that specific goal in mind and specifically tailor his philosophy to achieve that goal. Doesn't mean he's wrong automatically, but it does mean that maybe we should pay a little closer attention. Maybe we should be a little bit more on our toes. Okay, so more modern stuff coming up next.